You staying home tonight?
I hadn't planned on it, no.
Plan on it.
Brought to you this week by Miss Massacre's Guide to Murder and Vengeance, the beautiful pink book that Jessica and I both love, which we'll talk about a little bit more at the close of the show. This is Renee, and I'm drinking a very strong bourbon and Coke. Kit, how are you doing, and what are you drinking?
I'm doing good. I'm sitting here with a pint of Guinness, which is my typical choice.
I just hope that that you don't get that level of intoxication that usually feels really good, but in this case might actually make you fall asleep on the phone with us. That's what I'm worried about. Jessica, what are you having?
I'm having some PBRs tonight. I'm being regular.
I feel like Kit's being very healthy, you know? He's getting his iron, and we're just boozing it up.
Right.
Oh, yeah, it's practically a meal. I mean, it's pretty
good. Yeah, it really is.
Really.
Okay.
It's funny. I'm going to share this. I think I might have shared this on the show before, but my in-laws are all English, and when I visited in the U.S., if you're pregnant and you have a drink, like, people will probably, like, beat you up. It's really, like, really taboo. But when we visited England, my mother-in-law was, like, practically pressuring me to have a drink. And she was doing, you know, well, when I was in hospital with whichever child, you know, they made me drink Guinness because it helps replete your iron, and it helps with breastfeeding, and da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah, the iron deficiency thing. It was prescribed, practically. Yeah, you could practically get it in the NHS. When you were pregnant back in the day,
Ward, like, they were legitimately, like, still in the hospital and drinking Guinness, which is awesome. I would have loved to have a beer after I had my kid.
Fantastic, yeah.
So, you sent over two different books for us to check out. One was The Loving Husband and the Faithful Wife, and the other was Lifeline. I'm just going to jump in. What I found really different, I guess, about The Loving Husband and the Faithful Wife is it really felt like it was written in a more in Victorian style. Like, there's a lot of stiff upper lip and a lot of distance, even though it was a first person. Actually, I don't know if you know who Simon West Bulford is, but he has a novel that's written very similarly, but his, like, takes place, like, in the 1800s, whereas yours takes place in present time. Mm-hmm. And it was, for me, at first, I just assumed it, like, oh, well, this must be taking place, like, in the past, and then, you know, people are driving trucks and doing this and doing that. I'm like, oh, okay. And it took me a minute to get into it. Can I ask what made you feel that was the right voice for that story?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I'm glad you picked up on that, too, the voice, because it was a very deliberate choice. It took me a while. Once I came up with a core conceit of the story, which I don't want to say too much about, because obviously it's kind of the point of the story itself, but the key then became to me to find the right voice for it, to find the way in, and where I got to in the end, the voice that I kind of thought about that clicked for me was like, what if Dr. Watson was an unreliable narrator? That became like the core conceit, the idea of, like, what if the guy telling you the Sherlock Holmes story maybe is crazy, maybe isn't telling you the truth, maybe isn't telling himself the truth, maybe doesn't know. So it was a deliberate choice at that point to say, okay, so I want to have that very kind of stiff upper lip, old-fashioned kind of English-sounding voice. And that really, once that clicked into place, it wrote incredibly smoothly. It wrote very easily. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Holmes stories. I've read all of the short stories, you know, multiple times. I've got a really nice Folio Society collection of them on my bookcase. So, yeah, that's kind of where that came from, really. And then it just, but I mean, the great news is that that guy still exists. People like that still exist in the UK. I mean, it's a dying demographic, but it's nowhere near extinct yet. There's still, you know, still whatever, a million or so people who listen to Radio 4, who buy the Telegraph, who belong to that demographic. So he's, I guess he's eccentric slightly by UK standards, but he's definitely plausible as a human being. He's definitely
I feel like, you know, actually my husband has like a, I guess he's a friend now, but he was like a mentor to my husband. And he is a very, very eccentric old man that lives, I think he lives in Scotland now, but his letters do kind of come across that same way.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's there's a certain kind of, you know, it can almost seem like a stereotypical Englishness. And I think it is, certainly with this guy, it is specifically English as well, as opposed to British. I think there's certain strains of it that are very English in terms of his speech and his behaviour. But, yeah, like I said, I mean, it didn't feel like a cliche at any point, and it certainly didn't feel unreal at any point. It felt like a substantive human being. It felt like someone who did actually exist in the world, which is encouraging.
Right.
I hope you felt like that to other people as well. It certainly did to me.
I thought it, well, it's funny, as we said in the pre-show meeting, neither Jessica nor I realized that you were British. I didn't realize until I started reading. So I thought it was really funny because I'm reading, you know, and kind of like, well, this is a weird narrative choice, but all right, let's see how it works. And then, like, I got the context clues from just, like, certain words that we don't use in American English or whatever, and like, oh. And then it dawned on me what I was actually reading, if that makes sense. It was like, oh, okay, yeah, all right. So one thing I noticed in both pieces, actually, is you do tend to do a lot of writing from the body, which it isn't exactly common, but I think it's starting to get there maybe a little bit. Do you find that challenging, or is that something that comes naturally to you? Or like for instance, in Lifeline, there's like a couple pages worth of just pain. There's no other way to really describe it. It's not violence. It's literally pain.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's it's a conscious choice, certainly, to do that. It's, I think, easier. And comes fairly naturally when I'm writing in first person. Third person's obviously a slightly different proposition in some ways, but all the stories that I sent you were first person narrative stories, so that it helps in that sense. Yeah, and in that sense, it does come fairly easy because I think it's where we all live, you know.
Yeah.
And it, one of the things I think that's important to me in my writing is to try and like authentically portray the human experience, want of a less wanky term. And fundamentally the human experience is we all live in a physical shell. We all have this body that we live in, and for all that, our minds can take us to interesting places. I think more than we often realize, we're tied into the physicality of our existence, and we're completely, you know, I don't know if we're completely ruled by it, but it's certainly in certain circumstances we're completely ruled by it, and it's a very strong factor in our thinking and our decision making all the time. So yeah, conveying that physicality, and I feel like it's a generalization, but I think a lot of writers tend to live in their heads rather than live in their bodies, if that makes sense. A lot of writers tend to, you know, we spend a lot of our time exploring imaginary worlds and visiting kind of, you know, esoteric, intellectual, whatever. But I think it's quite important to link back to the physical when you're telling a story, because it is where we live. And I mean, Lifeline in particular is a very physical story. I mean, it happens in a confined physical space. It's a physical confrontation in a lot of ways. So it's important. I mean, it's kind of necessary to tell that strongly at that point.
And I thought, well, here's what I always think reads really true, and I'm going back to the loving husband and the faithful wife. When he's describing what he's going, I don't want to give anything away, but
no,
he's describing what happens when his wife answers the door. And he's also taking note of all these physical cues coming from her.
Yep.
Very sensual and like sexual, basically. I mean, it's sexual. I
sure.
guess I can give that much away.
Yeah.
So
they're married. It's okay.
I felt like that was actually really like, I don't think that many writers think to put those kind of physical descriptions on a secondary character in a first-person narrative.
Okay.
Whereas he's seeing it, and he's putting it together himself, and now you kind of get it, and he, obviously, he wants the reader to come to a certain specific conclusion that he's come to, but there are 100 different reasons why these things could be happening. And what I liked a lot, too, is, like, the fact that he seems to think that he's just such a wonderful husband, but, like, oh, my God, I would kill my husband if he was like that. Like, I just, like, seriously,
yeah.
Like, nobody needs to know anybody that well. Nobody needs to be that far up anybody's ass. Like...
Well, and, you know, but also, yeah, and also, is he really, right? Like,
right,
to what degree is all of that just in his head in the first place? To what degree is she kind of blissfully unaware that she's got this insanely obsessive kind of, you know, detail-analyzing guy behind the pair of eyes of the guy she thinks of as a, you know, like, there's that whole kind of... there's a really fun exercise in terms of trying to see that story through her point of view, you know? Trying to figure out who is this guy? What does he
yeah.
look like from the outside?
You know, it's nice. I've loved that seeing more of the unreliable narrator. Like, again, something I don't want to give a lot away on, but the Gone Girl is blowing up, and that was another, like, fantastic exercise with unreliable narrators because it's told from two different first-person points of view, and you don't know who's telling the truth. And sometimes at the end, like at the end, you're like, "Wait a minute, I still don't know who was telling the truth about
right.
half that stuff." So,
yeah,
I think that's fun because it makes you work a little bit, but in a way that's really enjoyable.
Sure, and I think. I mean, my most recent contention, I've thought about this a lot. I mean, the two pieces I sent you, incidentally, the first two serious bits of writing I did when I sat down to start writing again. So I've been writing for about 3 years seriously now, but they're the first, literally, pieces one. And The Lifeline was the very first. Loving Husband was the second. The Debt was the third. That's the third. That's the other story in the Loving Husband book. So I've done a fair few things since then, including, you know, third person, amongst other things. But one of the kind of central contentions that I keep coming back to in my writing and in life to a degree is that I think there's no such thing as a reliable narrator. I'm kind of getting to that conclusion. We all see life through our own lens and through our own set of, you know, prejudices plus biology plus experience plus whatever. You know, kind of, you know, whatever we ate for lunch. And I think that, I don't think there is such a thing as a 100% reliable narrator. I think we all see ourselves as the star of our own movie, don't we? We all think of ourselves in those kind of terms, and that colours how we perceive other people based on how they behave towards us and, you know, world events. We always find a way of relating them back to ourselves that's natural, as human nature. So, I think that, although The Loving Husband's a particularly kind of fierce example of that, I guess, because of the nature of what happens in the story, I hope it's a component with everything I write to a degree. There's always that feeling for me of, like, you know, people aren't always honest with themselves. So the idea that they would be honest with, you know, someone they're telling a story to about themselves seems kind of unlikely to me.
True. It's funny, though. I think it's even true a little bit in third-person narrative because if you think about it, any good book holds back information until it has the most impact to tell it to you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And when I write in third person, that's actually a huge part of what I'm doing, is like figuring out what to hold back until the end. So, yeah, I think you've just blown my mind a little bit. You just can't trust any narrator, even the omnipotent one.
especially the omnipotent one, I think. I mean, yeah, you know, that's it's interesting you say that, because the one of the things is I'm still wrestling with it, and I apologize for the fact that I didn't get it to you guys in time for this, but I'm still writing my first novel. It's like 90% done now, maybe even 95, but getting that final bit across the line where I'm actually happy with every chapter, I'm happy with the layouts, it may in fact end up killing me, we'll see. But one of the key components of that is that that's a third person narrative with a small medium sized cast of characters. I guess there's about 9 main characters, and you spend, the initial conceit was you'd spend a chapter with each character and then a transition chapter where you visit with everybody, so it's third person, but you know, you head hop a bit, and I was, you know, it's telegraphed, so you know that's coming, so hopefully it's not too jarring. But yeah, I mean, absolutely one of the key components of that story. I mean, if it works, one of the main reasons it works is precisely because of that, because there's you know, I'm concealing information about not all of the characters that you meet, but most of them have something concealed about them that's revealed through the story, because it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of the fun of a book, right, is that peeling back of the layers of the characters that you meet. And the advantage you've got with a novel over a short story and novella is you've got more time to do that, right? And you can do it with more people,
yeah.
Like you can gradually kind of peel apart the cycles. And of course, you know, in this particular story, as may not surprise you based on what you've already read of my stuff, they, you know, this group of people are put in a very, very, very high pressure situation, right? So there's a sense in which, you know, what is incredibly high pressure, what does that reveal about a person, you know, for good and ill? How does that strip apart, you know, the kind of surface or superficial layers of the personality and reveal? Or does it, you know, does it draw those superficialities to the surface? Do they become obsessed with minutiae in the face of some kind of existential threat, you know? I mean, you know, Lifeline obviously is very much about that. Lifeline's about, you know...
Right.
A kind of incredibly ordinary person thrust into a kind of nightmare scenario, and then it's all about, you know, how does that, you know, how do they respond to that?
One thing that I thought was pretty cool, I guess, in Lifeline was that there was woven into it a lot of music. And I understand, are you in a band? Is that, or am I wrong?
That's right. Yeah, no, that's right. I'm the lead singer in the near-legendary rock band, The Disciples of Gonzo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So I just have to know, I'm always fascinated by people that are, like, good at and pursue, like, several different creative pursuits, because I'm like, I'm good at this writing thing.
Mm-hmm.
But don't ask me to draw. Don't ask me to play an instrument or sing. Don't ask me to, like, make something out of clay. So which one did you come to first?
Well, the music. But that's just, it's just pure love, that's all. I mean, it's a pretty pathetic cliche, but I think it's true for me as a teenager that kind of loud music kind of saved my life. I grew up in a very small village in a very rural part of the country, and to say I didn't fit in very well, didn't belong, would be a massive understatement. And none of this is unusual. This is a very well-trodden story for a lot of people, I'm sure. But in my particular case, I don't know, you may have picked up on this in one of the My Life in Horror columns, but basically Appetite for Destruction came into my life when I was about 11, I think, or 12. And it just completely changed my perspective on almost everything, or it feels that way at this distance. It feels like it was one of those revelationary moments when I heard it. It was just like, oh, right, you can do that. Music can do that, and art can do that, and people can... It's okay to be angry and confused about the state of the world, and other people are as well. And you know, it was young enough to project all kinds of stuff onto that album that maybe weren't there, but that's okay too. You know, I mean, whatever. You know, but that was definitely a revelatory moment. And I mean, to this day, I love that record. But this day, I pretty much love all kind of long-haired rock and roll. It's a big, big part of my life, and I grew up with it, and I mean, you know, that's probably still my favourite album for nostalgia reasons, but I think, you know, if you were to ask me objectively what I thought the best album ever made was, I'd probably go with, like, the Rage Against the Machine debut, because it's just an unbelievably intelligent album. The musicianship on it is exceptional, everything about that record, you know, it created a new genre of music and is still the best album in that genre of music after, you know, 20 odd years. No one's topped that in rap metal. No one's come close to that. And I had it when I was 14, right? I mean, that was just like, I'm in Devon on a school bus, getting a bus driver to play it on cassette, you know, and just all these kids are looking at me like, what the hell is this? Like, the coolest kids had maybe heard of Public Enemy, but no one had Rage Against the Machine, you know. It was completely, yeah. Anyway, so yeah, the music always, but like, I had no confidence, and I did GCSE music, and I wanted to sing for my performance, and my puberty hit me late, so my voice broke a week before I was due to do my singing performance. So I completely screwed it up, and I had to play guitar instead, which I wasn't very good at. So I didn't pass GCSE music. That's all my CV if I ever have a platinum album that I can say I failed GCSE music. I'm obscure and proud of that.
Could you do me a favor and explain what GCSE is to our American listeners? Because I have a pretty good idea of it, but I don't think I could explain it.
Okay, no, that's cool. Transatlantic translation. So back when I was at school, so this is like the mid-90s by the time I finished. So it was, I mean, it still is the qualification that you do at 16. So in the UK school system, you're mandatory at school till 16. You do GCSEs. You do them in like anything between 8 and 14 subjects, right? So they're kind of small. And then the idea is you then go on from 16 to 18 to do A-levels, which prepare you for a degree, which you then go on to college, university for. No, so it's the qualification level that you do at 16, basically.
I think it's interesting that you talked about that kind of music. I think that pretty much you can take a poll of the music people liked when they were like 14, 15, 16, and that sort of defines the person they are as an adult in some ways. And in a lot of ways, whatever it is you glam onto at that time, it gives you that sense of, oh, yeah, there are other people like me, and somehow this gives me that. Because everybody, whatever group they're in, they're kind of alone when they're teenagers because they're going through all kinds of weird shit. And so, but somehow that whatever music they get into and whatever really speaks to them gives them that sense of, oh, okay, yeah, there's other things out there and there's other people like me.
Sure, I think that's right. And it definitely, I mean, for me, that sense of identity was huge because I didn't, I'm just pouring my second drink here. I didn't have a huge peer group anyway, because the village, I mean, you know, the village I grew up in had a population of 500, okay? So you're talking, there was one girl who was my age and a boy who was my age and another boy who was, like, in the year under us at school, so, like, a year younger. And that was it. Those were the kids in the village. All the other kids were older and hated us for whatever reason. So... like, because we were younger, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I guess because we hadn't discovered the Clash yet. They were all into the Clash, so we were.
You
go. But we liked Guns N' Roses, so we were like the Antichrist, you know. Which, looking back, that's, you know, I can completely relate to their position, actually, but at the time it felt a little unfair.
I think it's super funny that, like, in Britain, the Clash was just kind of always, like, in.
Yeah.
Because here, you know, here it's considered, like, you have Should I Stay or Should I Go? And, like, that's all that's on the radio, right? Or...
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the Clash is interesting because there's, like, for me, it's like there's the Beatles and the Stones, and, like, of course you can enjoy both, but you will have a preference, and that
exactly.
preference will tell me, that preference will tell me an awful lot about you as a human being, and it's the same thing for the Clash and the Pistols, I think. And in the UK, it's a big thing. I mean, it's really interesting. Johnny Rotten's, he's got a book coming out, right? So he's doing a bunch of publicity at the moment. He did a web chat on a newspaper, so it was The Guardian, I think, maybe even yesterday, a couple of days ago. And he was asked, the very first question was about the Clash. Whose cultural legacy is more important? He was asked the Clash or the Pistols, and he just said, nobody cares about the Clash. That was his entire...
Was he just straight up rude about everything? Cause that's what I've noticed
really
about his interview.
Direct, I think, is a fair description of Johnny Rotten's style.
There you
yeah.
go. Yeah.
Still, yeah. But
right,
it was. Sorry, go on.
I would say, what does it tell you about me then? I prefer the Beatles over the Stones, but I like both. Love the Clash. I would not piss on Johnny Rotten if he was on fire. I hate the Sex Pistols so much.
Okay,
really?
I'm not surprised. If it's very rare you'll have a Beatles fan who prefers the Pistols.
But the Beatles and
the Clash are on, I think, are on the same side of the musical divide, and the Stones and the Pistols are on the other.
I can see that, but
I'm kind of the opposite.
You're a Beatles fan and you like Sex Pistols.
Yes.
Oh, really? That's interesting. That's a less usual path traveled, I found. Because the thing about it is like, for me, I mean, I'm going to annoy people, but that's fine. When I look at the Beatles and the Stones, for me, the difference, really, the problem with the comparison is that it is a category error. Because the Beatles are a pop band.
Right.
They are the first pop band and
unarguably
the best pop band there's ever been. And the Stones are the best rock and roll band there's ever been. And it's a different category of music.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Now, my flag's in the rock and roll camp, so I prefer the Stones. But that's what it is, and it is a category error to compare them. And I actually think, with the Clash and the Pistols, although they are both punk bands, there's so many fundamental differences with how they approach it. And the Clash is so much more intellectual, there's no question, and the Pistols are so theatrical, even though they denied it, but they obviously are.
Yeah, that's what I hate about it.
Well, they were created, too, yeah. It was more of a...
That's what I hate about them, because it was so obviously for show.
Right.
Well, here's where I get to that stuff.
They're like Manson of 80s punk, late 70s.
Oh, well.
It's interesting you say that about Manson, though, because that's one of those. The early Manson was something I was really into.
I like a lot of Marilyn Manson songs, and I think that he was always really upfront about what he was doing.
Yeah,
whereas
yeah,
the Sex Pistols tried to make it like, oh no, this is really who we are, and there's tapes of Johnny Rotten like setting people interviewing him up to be like, I don't go by Johnny Rotten anymore, call me Jonathan Lydon, please don't say this or that, and then they would do exactly what he said, and he'd like jump up and like flip the table over, I'm Johnny Rotten, blah blah blah, and it's just like, man, fuck that, like, that's so the opposite of what I like about punk rock.
But was that a step, or was he just so high that he forgot what he said, right? I mean,
probably
like, you
that,
know,
yeah.
I mean, come on.
In the late
70s, the guy was on so much. Yeah, I mean, look, Johnny Rotten's gloriously inconsistent. There was a great, again, in that same interview, someone asked him, do you still hate Pink Floyd? And he just replied, I never hated Pink Floyd. And it's like, shut up, dude. You totally like, it's like, the thing about Johnny Rotten is I genuinely think that, like, his reality is whatever he's thinking at that moment. like he doesn't have any kind of like memory of anything he's actually said
right.
in the past. But it's just where he lives now is the totality of his reality and is all that has ever been, right? Just completely.
Every time he blinks, he forgets, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And every time he blinks and he forgets and he comes up with something new, that's the way it's always been. And anyone who says otherwise is a liar, you know? It's just like, but the thing about the Pistols, and I'd say this about Manson as well, and I'd say this about Slipknot as well, who are another one of those bands who get attacked for their theatricality and blah, 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 is listen to the album. You know, with the Pistols, forget all the image, forget all the hype, forget all the nonsense and Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious and swastikas and all that crap. Listen to Nevermind the Bollocks and tell me that is not a phenomenal rock and roll album.
It's so good.
Can I swear on this podcast?
Oh, yeah.
It's fucking amazing. It's fucking amazing, that record. You know? I mean,
right.
However,
who wrote it?
I don't care. I genuinely couldn't
care. I
care
because I think it matters. I want to support, like, okay, whatever. I don't want to get into it. I hate them
so much. No, I like getting into
it's
it.
It's irrational
cool.
how much I hate them. I can't. I respect Marilyn Manson. I think it's great. Like, his, especially, like, when he just really went all in with the theatrics,
yeah.
I'm down with it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really like Lady Gaga, but I'm down with, like, her whole thing.
You know what? And I'm the same. I mean, pop music is the one genre of music that I find almost nothing to like about, and I accept that's taste, but I can appreciate certain artists. You know, Madonna's one that always springs to mind. Certainly the 80s Madonna, 90s Madonna, and yeah, Lady Gaga's in the. But I always thought, look, Marilyn Manson and Lady Gaga had an awful lot in common.
Yeah,
I mean, I really think
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear when you look at them for more than 5 minutes. So there's a lot. And I'm glad. I think they did finally collaborate on something, didn't they? I don't know the details of it. Yeah, I'm out of the loop on it, but I'm pretty sure I read that they'd collaborate on something, which I was very happy about because, I mean, Manson could do with the money at this point. And it seemed like a good pairing because I do. I think that genuinely they're kind of culturally they're operating in, although they're in different musical genres, culturally they're operating in a very similar space, I think. And she's clearly an incredibly smart woman, right? She clearly,
yeah.
you know, is very engaged with what she's doing and very aware of what she's doing. And I felt the same way about Manson at his peak when he was doing that. You know, the trilogy of albums that began with Antichrist Superstar, there really was a sense of a, I mean, whether you liked it or not, but it was a sense of a real intelligence at work. You know, someone really kind of,
yeah.
and a vision too. You know, someone really sweating hard to try and make something happen. And I've always got a huge amount of respect for that, you know.
Okay. Well,
you see, you got me on this is it. What are you doing?
I don't know. This is so fun. I really like this. I was hoping Renee would yell some more about why she didn't like it, but she didn't do that for us. So I think
honestly, I could do this for hours. This is not a good thing. Don't get me on started on this stuff. Yeah.
No, it's good. I actually really enjoyed that. I wanted to switch gears real quick because we're nearing that halfway point. I want to make sure we get plenty of time to yell about other things too.
Oh, cool.
Because I found out that you write columns for the Ginger Nuts of Horror.
Yeah.
And you recently, I guess it was last month, you wrote two posts about Hellraiser, one about the original, and then you wrote another one about Hellraiser 2 and how you think it's the better Hellraiser movie. And
yeah.
what's interesting about that, because I just saw this, this week that you wrote these.
Okay.
And I had the beginning of October, we decided we were going to watch horror movies all month long. And we were going to alternate between ones we hadn't seen before and then also classic ones that we just loved and wanted to revisit. And the very first one I saw was Hellraiser, because I've got to see this movie again. So I was so excited. I saw Hellraiser at the beginning of the month. And then I read your article today, and I was like, okay, I don't know if I agree with this or not, because I can't remember Hellraiser 2 well enough. So I before the interview tonight, I watched Hellraiser 2, so I could have it fresh in my mind.
Oh,
I'm going to say, oh, I'm on my game right now. Hellraiser 2, I do not think it's better.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
We watched Hellraiser 2 to prepare to disagree with you, and I just hate watched Sex Pistols videos.
I read your article, and I thought, okay, these are really good points. It was well thought out. You know, everything had a good paragraph to support why you thought it was better. And some of the points I absolutely agree with, but on a whole, I just don't think it was. I agree, like, Julia was a better villain than Frank. She was more fun. I thought it was weird that somehow Death and being brought back changed her hair color, but that was fine. I could do that.
It's, you know, come on. Like,
these,
it's going to have an effect.
Happen.
You know,
I think I know why, though. And I don't know how many of our listeners are going to have Hellraiser so well in their mind right now that they're going to even remember this. But
there's a disturbing number of people who know Hellraiser incredibly well, as I've discovered having written the title.
Well, in the first one, Julia has this kind of, I thought it was reddish, but I'm not sure. Anyway, it's definitely not the dark brown long hair that she has in the second movie. And at the end of the film, they do a little switcheroo on you where Kirstie kind of dresses up, I'm going to say. I feel like I don't have to worry about spoilers if it's Hellraiser 2, right? Everybody's
seen
it.
It's fine.
Say
this to the listeners now. If you haven't seen it yet, come on.
Sorry.
Yeah, right.
So Kirstie puts on her skin.
What's wrong with you people? Sorry.
And no, you're fine. And I think that the reason they made Julia have the dark brown hair was so that little switcheroo would work at the end. So that she could wear the false skin and not have to wear a wig or whatever for the hair. I know that seems like I was thinking about it too much, but I was.
No, I like that. I love that level of thinking about a film. That's cool. No, you're almost certainly right. I can't see another reason why you'd do that. So, yeah.
But one thing I wanted to talk about was the Cenobites.
Okay.
In this one, you get the same Cenobites, and so that's good.
Yeah.
You know, the same four that you see in the original, they're still there. And and then you get a new one, but, that, you know, that's in, whatever.
Sounds like something I want to eat.
But they humanize them.
Yeah.
Literally. And that killed it for me. I hated that. I wanted them to still just be these crazy hell monsters. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I say about in the conclusion of that, I mean, the first thing I want to say about the article is it was headlined Devil's Advocate, and there's a reason for that. So one of the things that I've started doing with Ginger Nuts, I'm looking forward to doing more of as we go through. Most of the stuff I'm talking about, I'm enthusiastic about. It's stuff I saw as a kid, and it's stuff that influenced me, so I'm revisiting it, and I'm really enjoying it. But occasionally, I'm going to revisit stuff, and it's not going to stand up, right? So, and in those cases, I think I'm going to have to be honest about that. Now, I did that to a degree. I did one on the Wasp album, The Headless Children, which I completely adored at the age of 11. And having gone back and listened to it, some of it stands up, some of it kind of doesn't. And I had to talk a bit about that. So, one of the ones I've got coming up is the film Lost Boys, which again I saw at 14 and loved, and went back to and was like, oh, I didn't just dislike it, I actively hated it. I mean, anyway, so I'm really looking forward to writing that one because I know it's going to upset a lot of people because I'm just going to rip that film to shreds. But anyway, so back to Hellraiser 2. So, you know, I was watching it and, like, for me personally, it still holds up. I really, really, really enjoyed it. But I could see how, like, there were certain aspects of it that I could see would be problematic for people. So I had a choice at that point in terms of writing about it. Do I write like a flat review of it and try and you know, talk about that, or do I try and do something different? And I'd already done a kind of fairly straight review for the Hellraiser, the first movie, so I thought, no, let's go for it with this one. You know what I mean? Let's go for it with the writing and see if I can do something more interesting. So as a kid, I remembered liking Hellraiser 2 more than the first one. I suspect mainly because it was just grosser and scarier to me at the age of whatever I was, 13. So I just decided to...
It definitely is grosser.
It is grosser. It's really, really horrible. The opening half an hour, I think I'd put up against, you know, pretty much anything in terms of sheer... The combination of grossness and psychological, right? I mean, the bit where the guy takes the doctor takes the elevator ride down to the basement.
Yeah.
And oh, my God, man. That is just so horrific. The panning shot along the pipes, right, with the steam and the drip of water and just the screams. It's like, are we already in hell? What's going on here? You know, and the padded cells and the... Yeah, I mean, that was just really grim. So, sorry, you asked about humanizing the Cenobites. I'm rambling completely.
No, you're fine.
I think that... I mean, where I come down on that is... It's about expanding the mythology from the original film. And I think that one of the questions you have after watching the original film, you know, 30 or 40 times is, where do these things come from? You know, who are these creatures? Where do they come from? You didn't have to answer that in a second movie, but I think I have to applaud the decision to try and do that, to try and figure it out. And it's, you know, from what you're saying, okay, so clearly the explanation isn't to everyone's taste, that's fine. But I think I said something like this in the article, part of the reason I think Hellraiser 2 is a better film, or, you know, if I'm being honest, maybe a better film, it may not be. But for me, if it is a better film, one of the reasons is the sheer ambition of the second movie, the way it reaches so far forward from the premise of the original to try and, you know, find new ground and find new things to say. And I think the bit you're talking about, the humanization of the Cenobites, the origin story, for like I said, it's all that will be, you know, albeit a sketchy one, is all part and parcel of that reaching for something new. It doesn't trade on past glories. It doesn't. It would have been so easy for Hellraiser 2 just to give the box to someone else. You know, it would have been so easy to do that. Just give the box to someone else and tell another version, just reiterate on basically the original premise. You know, hey, maybe give it to a woman this time and have it be a guy who helps bring about whatever. It would have been very, very easy to do. But the fact that they decided to start, you know, a very short period after the first film end and just take everything that happened in the first film and just run as far and as hard and as fast as they could in a direction to try and make it happen. I'm so impressed with that, and I'm kind of more impressed with it now as an adult in a way than I was as a kid, because I've seen more horror sequels, and I've seen how bad they usually are.
That's
true. You know what I mean, and how derivative they normally are, and how little they're prepared to be brave and iterate. I mean, this is kind of a pet peeve of mine, but like it's a real issue with the kind of franchise. The movie franchise, and in particular the horror movie franchise, is, you know, we found something that works, guys. This generates money, so let's do it again. But let's not fuck with it. You know, let's not change it or make it interesting in any way. Let's just how close can we retread this and get away with it? So you end up with this raft of like sequels and remakes and reboots that are just the same goddamn thing over and over and over again. And it was to me, it's like Hellraiser 2. That's the one I'd point out to people, saying, that's how you do a sequel. And like I said, I mean, you know, I'm honest enough to say, I mean, even, of course, there are times when the reach exceeds their grasp. There are problems, there are limitations of the effects, there are limitations even with the storytelling at times. But I'm just so gobsmacked by how ballsy they were and how hard they reached, you know. And I just, that's the thing for me that elevates
you
the film.
You really explain this so well that I'm starting to be like, yeah, okay, maybe. And I just finished it, and I just finished saying, like, no, this is a shit movie, and I can't wait to tell him that this is a shit movie. But you do convince me, and I understand your point that they are at least trying to continue that story. I will say, and I put this on Facebook, there are so many fucking doctor puns in that. Do you after they turn that guy into a Cenobite,
he's like,
here's your prescription for pain. I'm like, stop now, please. Are you kidding me?
That's how you know he's really evil, right? That's how you know he's really evil. And kind of a good guy. At least Pinhead doesn't make shitty puns the whole time, right? That's how you know Pinhead. Like, on the scale of evil, Pinhead's not as bad as... That's why you're rooting for Pinhead. Like, God, get him! Get that fucking punning bastard! Get him!
I will say... And that kind of reminds me of, like, Halloween 2. Because that's a direct sequel to Halloween 1. Obviously, I'm talking about the originals, by the way.
Yeah.
I would never say it's a better movie, but at least they do continue that story and try and give you more with that story.
It's really fascinating you say that, because Halloween's 2, the other film that I could actually try and make a case for it being a better sequel than the original, I really could. I'm not sure it is, but I think you could make a case for it. Do you know what I mean? I think you could make an argument for it. So I think Halloween 2 is an exceptional film. I think it's a great horror movie in its own right, and I think you could almost... I think an argument could be made that it's a better film than the original, although that's complete heresy. It does. It absolutely does. It's a great film.
I'm
not going to do it for Elm Street 2, by the way. Elm Street 2 is where I draw the line.
No, yeah.
Elm Street 3 maybe, though. You could make a case for 3.
Elm Street 3 I talked about tonight, because the young girl, with the color Tiffany in this one, I was like, oh, isn't that the one from Dream Warriors? Isn't that Patricia Arquette? But it wasn't. So the whole night it was not Dream Warriors that I was talking about.
What's funny, though, is what I was going to say, is that because I told Jessica before you called in, I was like, I thought we were just going to talk about horror movies. I didn't realize we were going to talk specifically about sequels. So... What I should have done is watch From Dusk Till Dawn 2, because Netflix keeps recommending it to me like it's something I would do voluntarily. From Dusk Till Dawn, because it's like a Tarantino-ish movie, but it's not. And it's like a Rodriguez movie, but it's not. It's a crime movie, but it's not. It's a horror movie, but it's not. Like, Netflix doesn't know what the fuck to do with recommendations on that. There were, like, reality TV shows mixed in. I was like, why would I watch The Real Husbands of Hollywood because I like From Dusk Till Dawn?
I don't know, but do me a favor and do that before you watch Dusk Till Dawn 2, okay?
Yeah, exactly.
There's more genuine horror involved in Real Husbands of Hollywood.
It's a different kind of horror,
God.
Though, let's be honest.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Still.
But, okay, real important thing on Hellraiser, and this can be one or two, which one is your favorite Cenobite? You must pick.
Wow. Well, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean...
Mm-hmm. We have a hard-hitting question.
Wait, hang on. You're going to have to define favorite for me, because that's a loaded term. You could read that in a number of ways. So help me out with the word favorite. Worst? You mean scariest?
I don't know. Like, I personally have a favorite. And so I just feel like you should, too.
Okay, well, I mean...
You just enjoy the most.
No, it's got to be the main man. It's got to be Pinhead. I mean, he gets because he gets the best lines. He gets almost all the lines, which is a little unfair. But he's the man. I mean, he's just the performance is. I mean, they're all great, but his performance is just incredible. Especially, I have to say, in the first movie, where he has less to do. Oh my God!
To show you,
all that stuff. So, I mean, the second movie, he gets a bit more whimsical, doesn't he? He gets that whole kind of, you know.
He does,
and that's kind of, it's interesting. I mean, it works for me, but I know it doesn't work for everyone. But in that first movie, he's just completely unparalleled. It's got to be Pinhead for me. I love Barbie Wilde in the second movie. I love the female Cenobite in the second movie. It's a different actress to the first movie. And she gets that great line about, are you trying to tease us, Kirsty? And it's her delivery on that line, it just kills me. I wrote about that in the article. It leapt out at me on the rewatch. It was such a great line. It's such a brilliant delivery.
I've always been a fan of the female Cenobite in the first movie. because she also, I think she gets as, she doesn't get as good of lines, but she at least she gets to speak, you know.
she
gets some lines,
yeah, yeah.
She gets to say some cool stuff. I like it. And the second one, and I'm going to have to go back and like Google some stuff, I'm not sure, but I feel like her neck wound was not as pronounced in the second one, and that might just be my imagination.
No, you're not, right, and it's a different actress, it's a different makeup job, yeah.
Well, I knew it was a different actress, but I wasn't sure if it had really changed that much, but it was still good. I'm not going to say,
sure.
You know, I still enjoyed it. It was just not exactly the same, and I wanted to...
No, well, in the first one, the neck wound affects the speech.
Right.
She talks in that kind of dragged out whisper almost.
Yeah.
And in the second film,
like that.
That's not there in the same way. Yeah, no, that's cool.
So, okay, I'm gonna throw it.
Okay.
Favorite horror movie.
Oh God.
My favorite
define
horror movie.
That
that's, come on, man.
Define it how
that's
you need.
You have to like break that down into like so many subgenres.
I mean, like,
I know, but I have a favorite.
Okay, what's your favorite?
Well, good for you.
My favorite's The Exorcist.
Okay, yeah.
I guess.
I mean, that's, you know, you look at any sort of top 100 horror movie polls, The Exorcist is, if it's not number one, it's always in the top three, and
it's
often number one. It's, you know, I mean, yeah, it's unarguable.
It's
not even my favorite exorcism movie, to be honest, but it is good.
Blasphemy right there. You know what?
Yeah,
I feel like
there's a lot of good
ones. You want to hurt me because you know how I feel about that. How I don't even like watching exorcism movies because I feel like there's very few things that go into exorcism movies that weren't already in The Exorcist and done better, I think, in The Exorcist because of the way that it was filmed. And I know, way too much about the way it was filmed because I wrote a big thing about it. But there's also, like, there's a whole, it has its own real-life mythos around it about, like, the stuff that happened in the theaters and, like, everybody who, like, when they saw it, if they saw it, like, as a young preteen or teenager, there's, like, stories about it. Everybody has, like, a thing about The Exorcist. And so it becomes a whole, it's not just the movie, but it's the movie and the book, and it's the culture around it and, you know, whatever.
The Exorcist was a legitimate phenomenon. I'll give you. I mean, there's no question. And the reason it's the, you know, it always turns up in the top five, top three, and often in the number one slot in those polls is because of that. It's an incredible film.
It was a phenomenon.
Yeah, it was, and legitimately, and you're absolutely right that there's kind of no point in making an exorcism movie after that. You know, it's like making a shark movie after Jaws. Like, why would you fucking bother?
Right.
Like, it's been done. Like, move on.
Know,
you know,
Jaws
like
pretty good, but
yeah, right.
What modern
Shark Attack 3? You know,
the story up.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I don't know. I thought The Exorcism of Emily Rose was pretty good. Also, The Conjuring.
I did like The Conjuring, and I only watched it because you recommended it to me, so high five.
It was it's pretty awesome because it's a haunted house movie and a possession movie.
Exactly.
Ooh.
And,
gives you
and,
both.
But also, and it was just, it was a good cinematic film, like the story, the characters, you were invested in it. I feel like a lot of times now you watch horror movies and they don't really care if you care.
Yeah, and that absolutely sucks. I hate that. I mean, it's a fundamental storytelling error. Like, it's a fundamental fail if you don't identify. Identify is completely the wrong word. If you don't care about the characters, you don't even have to like them. That's the interesting thing that I've kind of discovered.
Right.
You don't have to like the characters, but you have to understand them. You have to believe in them, and you have to have some kind of investment in them, you know?
The Conjuring, like, touched me, which I thought was, like, that's new for horror. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's unusual, certainly.
Talking about The Exorcist, have you seen The Exorcist 3?
I've not seen any of the sequels. Why would I do that? I will watch From Dusk Till Dawn 2 and 3 before I watch the fucking sequels.
You are clearly
wrong. Here's the interesting thing about 3. I can honestly tell you, the same... I'd said in the article about Hellraiser 2, the first time I saw it was at a friend's house, and I didn't see all of it. I saw the first half an hour. At that same friend's house, I saw the last 15 minutes of The Exorcist 3, which
Exorcist
is all I've ever
3
seen.
3 is amazing.
Yeah. No,
I charged both.
It's got good write-ups. No,
oh,
no,
you
no.
have seen it now? Okay, good.
No, I haven't, but I've heard enough good things about it that I'm going to at some point. Because, yeah, I mean, I hear
must.
It. Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to watch it, but if it hurts me...
No, I demand that you both see it, because Exorcist 3 is just... I mean, it's fucking weird as shit.
Yeah.
Threes usually are. When you get to the third in anything, something they're going to branch off. Something weird is going to happen. Sometimes
you know,
there's kangaroos.
My favorite story about threes was after they made Jaws 2, and they said, if we're going to make a Jaws 3, it's got to be called Jaws 3 People Nil. It's the only way we can make that a third movie is if we call it that.
See, I don't know. I just don't know if I can handle it. I'll try it for you, Jessica. But you know, like,
hey,
no,
you know who it is? Maren, isn't it?
I do.
No, no, young one.
Every year.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I was making a whole thing in my head, and it wasn't making sense. But anyway, you're going to like
it. I do an Exorcist project. So last year, I did this huge article on the making of it and how that affected the phenomenon surrounding it and whatever. And this year, what I tried to do was collect first-time stories from people, and I failed so miserably. People say yes a lot more than they actually do what they say yes to. Hard lesson learned.
Oh, my goodness.
But I did get one, and it was great because the first time this guy saw it, it was the made-for-TV version. Yeah. And he was like, what the fuck is this? This isn't the scariest movie. This is lame.
Also, why is it only 20 minutes long? What the...
Right, I can't even imagine.
So then, well, I don't want to give it away. You guys, I'm going to link it up, and people should read it. It's great. It's like... Who does? Why does he bother? You know, because he talks about like his parents coming home from the movie theater when he was a little kid, and his mom is just like shell shocked and refuses to even speak of the movie ever again. He finally sees it, and he's like, "What?"
Hi. Yeah, that's kind of hilarious.
No, go on.
No, go ahead.
I'm gonna go.
I was just gonna say that. Uh-huh. All right, you go then.
They did an Exorcist prequel. Recently, it's not recently, it's probably in the last 10 years, but that's recent to me, right? And I can't see it on the shelf readily. Someone help me. Hold on. I got my librarian here. There we go. Exorcist the Beginning is what it's called. It is really good. Like, it's very, very good for a prequel movie. And it's got, like, a couple scenes with some Nazis in it, so that's exciting.
That's great.
Also recommend that.
Hey,
thank God it's
not
real today.
Yeah. No, just the made-for-TV movie thing. It's something I'm going to write about at some point for the My Life in Horror, because it's definitely a part of growing up and the kind of the way I got exposed to a lot of films. The classic on that for me was Die Hard. So I had the made-for-TV version of Die Hard. Oh, and Beverly Hills Cop. So the version of Beverly Hills Cop I saw had zero swearing in it. So I want you to just imagine what that film was like without any swearing in it, and just.
I had a friend.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
like what?
Like back in the day, I don't know if this is even true, but it seems true considering some of the fuck ups you would see on these like edited for TV ones. It seemed like they were dubbing over the swears like on the spot.
Yep.
And I had a friend when I was in my 20s his whole family had this like whole long running joke because of Die Hard where Dub said, "Yippee-ki-yay, melon farmer."
Wow. You know what's amazing about that? That was the story I was going to tell, only my version of it, and I'm not making this up. He says, "Yippee-ki-yay, kemosabe."
Oh my God.
swear to God. I swear to God. I probably got the VHS tape somewhere in my garage. I could probably dig it. Yippee-ki-yay, Kemosabe. That's what I spent the first 2 years of my diehard living experience thinking that's what he said.
See, I've seen the made-for-TV version of Kill Bill.
What is that, just missing the last half an hour? How does that even work?
It has a, you know, at the beginning, he says, my name is Buck, and I like to party. And I'm like, wait, what? Why would you even say that?
Don't they change the name of the pussy wagon, too? Don't they, like, do some weird CGI thing on that?
I have no idea.
Cut it all together.
I just remember party.
I find that whole concept. That's wonderful.
So I feel like there's something special about any Tarantino movie when it plays on TV, because automatically you're both like fascinated and horrified by what could happen.
Yeah, what have they done? The other one I remember, and it was, I mean, I wrote, it's one of the articles I wrote quite early on for Ginger Nuts, is about the film Robocop.
Yeah.
Which is probably, I don't know about a favorite horror movie, that's my favorite movie of all time, I think. And
wow.
There's this really important thing. It's like, it's the same thing with Appetite for Destruction. I can draw a distinction between my favorite and the best, right?
Mm-hmm.
Robocop is my favorite film. I'm not saying it's the best film ever made, but it is absolutely my favorite film. By, like, and it's not even close. But, like, I was lucky enough to see that on VHS first, so I saw it in its full sweary glory and with all the kind of, you know, violence and everything. But the TV version of that was hysterical because they really butchered it to try and get it down to, like, a 12A rating or the equivalent at the time. And, it's just... I mean, how familiar are you with Robocop? Because I'm grotesquely familiar with that film. I don't want to kind of...
Not that familiar, but I've seen it.
Okay. So there's a bit where Robocop walks into a robbery. He walks into the shop, and the guy's got a machine pistol, whatever he's pointing. He just says, and he basically says "fuck me" about 300 times while he's pulling the trigger and shooting, and the bullets are just bouncing off. And it's in the TV movie version, you know, "why me? Why me? Why me?" And like every time, there's a different reading of the word "why," and it's just like, geez, some guy was really trying to earn his overdub money here, you know? But it's so pathetic. It's so bad. You know, it's like, stop killing my film. But, like, they edited everything. Arsehole became Airhead. You know, like, it was just, like, what are you doing to my film? Funsters. That was my favorite. We're going to bust these funsters. I mean, God, oh, my. Yeah, right. It's just like, And then that one, as I say, luckily for me, I'd seen the original version first, so I could just laugh at it. But I dread to think what that would have done to me if I'd seen that one. You know, if I'd seen that before, I'd seen it.
I have to say, I am so happy to hear you say that your favorite movie is RoboCop, because I know that you were being completely honest with us with that.
that is not
your answer to try and be cool on this show. That is for real, and that's awesome.
No, honestly, all joking aside, like, the Ginger Nuts article that I am proudest of is the one I did on Robocop, because I actually pitched it to Jim. He was doing a series called The Book That Made Me, and I did him an article about Stephen King's It, because that's the first real horror book I read, and as you may imagine, I was too young, I was 11, and it completely shaped my kind of imagination in a lot of ways. But I said, we were chatting on Twitter, and there used to be a Twitter bot that would say, if you ever put the word Robocop into Twitter, it would come back at you and say, I'd buy that for $1 it was a bot. And I told him about it. I said, this is really cool. And then I did it, and nothing happened. I was like, what the fuck? And I looked at the bot, and it turned out the guy had taken it down because he was so angry about the remake that he didn't want to advertise the movie anymore. And I was like, And two things became immediately apparent to me. One, I love this guy because he shares my values, right? Like, fuck the remake. This is one of the greatest films ever made. And then I was talking to Jim off the back of that, the guy who runs Ginger Nuts. I just said, if you ever do the film that made me, I will write you a brilliant article about Robocop, because that film just... And he just said, I tell you what, we'll do it, and you can have the first article. You can do the inaugural piece. So I did, and it's... You know, it's hands down still, I mean, I've done a lot of stuff that I'm really happy with, but that, I'm so proud of the piece of writing I did for that, because it's just a pure expression of love, which is like the opposite of what I'm doing with my fiction. A lot of the time in my fiction, I'm kind of interrogating the kind of dark corners of of people and how they behave. It was really, it was so fun to just sort of crack open a bottle of scotch and just let rip on, like, just, you know, pure enthusiasm, just raw enthusiasm. And it, yeah, RoboCop, I have so much love for that film. And I got, you know, the articles, I start out with the article by positing a future in where, you know, an alternate reality in which RoboCop won every Oscar the year it came out. So, like, it's acknowledged as being the greatest movie ever made, and, you know, it was, you know, Reagan actually passed a presidential decree saying no one could ever make a sequel or a reboot so that the purity of the original would be maintained. You know, Roger Ebert retired from movie criticism having seen the original RoboCop movie. He said, there are no more worlds to be, you know, there are no more worlds to be conquered, three thumbs up, and he retired. That's it. It's done. You know, and it's, yeah, it was really fun because, yeah, I'm not trying to be cool. I just have, again, it's the age I was. I was too young. I was too young when I was 11, and it just imprinted on me. And I've seen the film. It's got to be, I don't know if I've reached 100 viewings of it yet, but I must be close. And I genuinely, I could sit down and watch it right now, and I would adore every second of it. I would laugh my ass off the entire way through because it's just, the thing about a film is it is a great action movie. It's a satire of an action movie. It's got horrific stuff to it. It's got comedy to it. It manages that really almost impossible trick of being the thing that it is and being a commentary on the thing that it is at the same time. And it is both because it stands as an action movie. It does. It's a great, great action movie. Most lists of action movies will have this film on it somewhere. It's a great sci-fi movie. But it's also a piss take of action movies, you know, and a piss take of sci-fi movies. It's incredibly smart film as well as being an incredibly dumb film.
Yeah.
I will see. I will say.
Do you just wind me up? What's next?
Oh, no. This is going to be my confession on the show. The movie Pet Sematary. I saw that when I was in fifth grade, and I cannot watch it to this day. Like, I've not seen it since. It scared the shit out of me. I'm never going to watch it again. It's over for me.
Yeah. No. I've got one of those as well, and that's Tommy, the Who movie, Tommy.
Yeah?
Yeah. My mum tried to get me to watch that when I was, like, 8, and it fucking terrified me. Absolutely, because it's the combination of the surreal nature of it, but also, like, the early sequences, there's a load of abuse, right? Like, when he's,
yeah,
you know, they're leaving him with the babysitters and all that, and it was somewhere in the middle of Cousin Kevin, I was just like, I cannot fucking watch this anymore. And it took me 20 years before I could go back to that film, and it's still, I think, still probably, for me personally, the scariest film. It's still the one I have the hardest time getting through.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Same to me. I haven't seen it, so.
It's quite something. It really is. It's aggressively psychedelic, but it's like, normally you play psychedelia for laughs, and this does not play it for laughs. It plays it for, I think, for horror, certainly for discomfort. It's pretty.
Yeah.
I can't think of a movie that affected me that way. I saw everything too young. So, okay. My dad was a very irresponsible parent, and my mom was very liberal, so, like, liberal about what we watched and what we read and stuff. So, like, yeah, everything too young. I mean, I was just talking about From Dusk Till Dawn. I saw that when I was, like, 10 or 11. I looked it up. I think it was 12 when it came out, so 12.
Okay.
I was 12. Borderline.
It's young enough.
Yeah.
Dusk Till Dawn's got some fear. I mean, never mind the vampires and everything. Tarantino's character in that film is...
Yeah.
Oh.
For the TV show, they made the really smart decision of making Richie Gecko not a pedophile rapist. They went a different direction with him. And I thought, you know, he's still a crazy psycho killer. But he's so much more likable when he's not raping people.
when he's not interested in having sex with children. Yeah, funny how that works. Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's like I say, for me, that's the creepiest thing in the film. But
yeah. Well, this is a weird way to go out, but we're over time right now, so.
Okay.
on the pedophilia rapist note, thanks for coming.
But I'm glad we managed to keep it non-controversial anyway. That's the important
thing. Yeah, that's what we do here. It's a good thing our sponsors are who they are, or we'd be in trouble all the time.
You're sponsored by Family Values. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Focus on the family. No. We are, in fact, sponsored by Paul Gonzalez's Miss Massacre's Guide to Murder and Vengeance, which is decidedly not family friendly. There's no pedophilia in it. But it's ugly and it's gritty and it pulls off the pulpy grindhouse thing without being funny about it, which I think is hard.
Or being terrible, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, even harder to not be terrible. It was great. It's a fantastic book. So it's got the Books and Booze seal of approval. And if you click the banner at the bottom of the page, it'll take you to where you can buy it. And then we'll link up Kit stuff and we'll link up the, I mean, Jesus Christ. You know, lately my notes for the episodes have been like 4 items or 5 items. And this one, like, I was running out of room and had to start a second column. So we're going to have a lot of music links. We're going to have a lot of movie links. We're going to have a lot of just random shit going on. I do not know for a fact if the lady box is still going to be available by the time this episode airs, because there's a limited amount of them. But being that we've featured all but one of the authors, and we will be featuring that author later, we want everybody to know that that's available. And music this week is about a happy concept.